Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
It was a hobby that turned into an unhealthy hobby that turned into a business.
This week, we welcome one of the founders of the reservation app Resy, Ben Leventhal. Before Resy, Ben has been involved in many digital food startups, including Eater. And that's when you and I met, right? And it was like 2006.
2006. Those halcyon days.
Exactly. So here to talk about making restaurant reservations in the state of digital food media and entrepreneurship in general is Ben Leventhal. Welcome to Special Sauce, Ben.
Thank you, sir.
So good to see you, my old friend. You know, it's funny because having Special Sauce gives me the ability to catch up with people that I ordinarily never get a chance to catch up with. So it's great to have you here.
It's a nice byproduct.
It is. So first of all, tell us about life at the Leventhal family table growing up.
What I can tell you is that we did eat together as a family most nights.
In Manhattan? You would live in Manhattan?
It was Manhattan, and before that it was Westchester.
Got it.
And so we were a family at the table. It was often homemade. I have vivid memories of both my mother and my grandmother cooking. My grandmother made apple pie from scratch and, you know, peeled the apples by hand until she was 96.
Wow.
And that was sort of the food context for us. It was a place where we sat down and made eye contact and talked.
What were you eating?
Well, I was a picky eater till I was about 20.
Okay.
Is the truth. Or 18 when I went to college and I gained 20 pounds eating pizza. But I was a really picky eater. So there was a struggle in my house to get me to eat things other than pasta and pizza and
hamburgers and meatloaf.
You know, it was all the carbs for me. And it's still my Achilles heel.
That's awesome.
But I loved my grandmother's chicken soup, which has now become my mother's chicken soup. I would always eat that. But even then, I was picky about what was in the broth. If it was too chunky, I wanted my mom to take certain things out of it because it sort of looked too gnarly to me. So I was definitely a picky eater, but I loved food.
Yeah.
That I remember, you know, from my earliest memories is that I really did enjoy sitting down and eating.
You weren't someone who's like, I got to figure out how my grandmother makes that apple pie. You were just like, I'm thrilled to be eating this apple pie and to be surrounded by people that are interested in what I'm doing.
I think that that's right, although I did certainly participate with them. I mean, I do sort of remember standing on a chair next to the counter, and I was 5 years old or however old I was, and I needed to stand on a chair to reach to see what was going on. And I remember all that, and I remember certain things like my mom showing me how to see if a cake was done. And I remember her saying, you know, the chicken soup is pretty good after 5 hours, but it's really great after 7 or 8 hours. I remember things about the process, but I was never obsessed with learning how to make these things.
There must have been a history of eating out.
We ate Sunday nights Chinese food.
Right.
Ate out
that's
every
a classic.
Sunday.
We ate it. My father used to, even though we were six, he'd say, oh, dinner for five will be enough. It's like, wait, look at who your sons are. It's not going to be enough.
Right, right. So we had a Sunday routine of going out to dinner. It would be Chinese for 2 months, and then it would be Italian for 2 months, and then it would be back to Chinese, and sometimes it would be an American restaurant or something like that. But Sunday nights was a night where, as a family, we went out to dinner. And I think that, you know, out of 52 weeks, we probably went out 40 to 45 a year from the time I was 5 to the time I was, you know, basically college age.
Right. And would you go to the same places? Would you rotate among like 4 different places, like an Italian place, a Chinese place?
Yeah, we were streaky. So so it was many weeks at a time, but then we would shift to a new place. Yeah. And we were always excited to try the new places. But being that I wasn't a particularly adventurous eater and neither was my sister, it wasn't like we were going to go and rush to the next molecular place that opened.
Right.
It was really about, you know, like, oh, this looks like a good new neighborhood spot. It looks pretty promising. Let's give it a shot.
Yeah. Is that where your love of going out to restaurants began And were you curious about the inner workings of restaurants even back then? Or was it mostly, hey, that's cool, I want to go out to eat?
It was definitely where I developed an obsession with restaurants, for sure. I don't think I had a lot of awareness of the inner workings. I do remember from the earliest days the maitre d'. I remember that at certain places we had a relationship with the maitre d', or we had a relationship with the server who always wound up at our table, and he would remember that I like this dish, you know, but I'd like the sauce on the side, or, you know, no mushrooms, or
right.
He doesn't want garlic. And I remember vividly the waiters that remembered that stuff.
Which is germane to Resi in a way.
100%. And I think generally speaks very much to how I now look at restaurants, which is I look at them for their hospitality and for the ambiance and for the setting and for how the place makes you feel sitting there at the table. Only when I started working on Eater and taking it kind of pretty seriously in terms of understanding the business, and now certainly with Resi, an understanding of the business is table stakes, that's when I started to sort of really be interested in the economics of restaurants and how they operate and who does what, and you got to run this at 30% and your occupancy has to be whatever it is.
Right.
That developed much later.
Later. So you went to GW, but you didn't, at that point, you didn't imagine making a living in the world of food or even being an entrepreneur, like either of those two things.
Wasn't even remotely in my mind, but in hindsight, there obviously were signs, but it wasn't in my mind. I studied economics and finance, and the idea was that I would go work at a bank. But I did not get a single
Thank
offer.
Thank God.
You know, I did internships in high school and college at places like MTV, and I did a couple of things in entertainment and sports. So those were sort of interests that sort of started to percolate. But it never occurred to me that what I needed to be doing ultimately is running my own business and starting my own businesses, and that would be the thing that made me happy. It wasn't there in the front of my mind yet.
Got it. And because your dad was a lawyer and your mom was a psychologist, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So in a way, they may have had aspects of running their own businesses, but they weren't entrepreneurs in the traditional sense of the word.
I think that's right. I do remember my father, the moment he opened his own practice, I remember that process actually quite vividly. He was meeting about it with the people that would become his partners. And then I remember going to the office space and helping him put together bookcases and really sort of, I remember him rolling up his sleeves and saying, this is going to be my business now.
Right.
And that was definitely something that stuck with me. Yeah, with, you know, lawyers and psychologists. My mother has a PhD in clinical psychology. That's, as you know, it takes years and years
to build up a practice.
To build up a practice.
Yeah.
And so I think definitely a different path.
And so you got out of school, you went to work at VH1, if I remember.
Yep.
And then how did Eater come about?
By this point, my obsession with restaurants was becoming pretty apparent.
You needed to go to Restaurant Goers Anonymous.
The thing that I didn't tell you, we haven't talked about in terms of my growing up, is that on my birthday, I got to look through the Zagat, and I got to pick three restaurants, any restaurants to try. And that was something that I was like, I was very excited about that as sort of the thing I did on my birthday. I wasn't interested in any big parties. I wasn't interested in
That's awesome.
Any of it except that I could drag my family to three restaurants.
So three restaurants in one day?
Correct. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But you have to understand, I'm 13, 12 years old. It was, you know, Rock Center Cafe for breakfast, Planet Hollywood for lunch,
right.
and Fashion Cafe for dinner.
Right.
I mean, I liked the theme places.
That's really funny.
But I was definitely a restaurant hunter by the time I graduated, meaning I was always looking for what was new and what was interesting, and I was definitely aggressively seeking out those places. And as a result, you know, VH1, there's a new crop of people that start working there every year right mm-hmm. out of school, and they need to be told where to eat. They've got to ask somebody for recommendations. You know, most of them are new to the city. They've just landed these super exciting, you know, entry-level jobs. Back then it was exciting. I'm sure
right.
now those jobs
sure.
are, you know, Snapchat and BuzzFeed. But they're very excited to be there, and they need somebody to tell them where to go. And so I sort of became that person at VH1 where my class of PAs and coordinators would come to me and say, hey, where should I
right.
go for this date, or what should I do for this, or my parents are coming into town, where should we go? And I had those answers somehow.
Right. Just like me. It's like when I was doing the advertising for Barks Root Beer and I was working at a boutique ad agency, got to the point where the guys in New Orleans, which is where Barks was located, was like, so where are we eating when you come down?
Right.
You know, it's like.
Right, right. So that was the lay of the land. And from there, that's, I think, probably when the entrepreneurial sort of tendencies kicked in, because I started this really kind of quirky newsletter called She Loves New York, which was really just...
I forgot about She Loves New York.
You know, that was just like this quirky weekly email newsletter that was basically the list of places that I had recommended that week.
Got it.
To all the different places of VH and to all different people.
And so it was just an email blast. And did you think that you would ever make money from it?
No, I didn't think, I didn't have really a sense of how it would be monetized at all. I'm a entrepreneur in terms of like idea and strategy and passion first. I don't often start with how it's going to be monetized. Some entrepreneurs do. Some entrepreneurs are really focused on monetization, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for
that. I wish I was too.
Right.
You know, it could have saved us a lot of heartache, dude.
What I've learned by this point is, if that's not you, you gotta pretty quickly identify who on your team is that person. You know, so I think that I've evolved a little bit over time. But with She Loves New York, I just kind of had this idea. I actually went to my dad and I said, you know, I'm kind of thinking about this thing. He gave me $5,000 for design to get the thing designed and to get the very basic software.
That was your first friends and family money.
I did a $5,000 friends and family round. Exactly. And that was the DNA for Eater. So it was this weekly newsletter where I basically was just sending, it was a list of 15 places. It had a quirky voice to it, but at the end of the day, that's what it was. And that was the DNA of Eater alongside my partner. Sort of, he had an obsession with with neighborhoods and with the physical space of a city.
Right, because he had his first blog was the real estate blog, right?
Lockhart started Curbed, and even before Curbed, when I was doing She Loves New York, now we're in the deep weeds now, but when I was doing She Loves New York, he was doing a site called, an eponymous site called LockhartSteel.com, and it had a section called Below 14th Street, which was basically a chronicle of the physical spaces below 14th Street. And so you look at the DNA of that site, Below 14th Street, and you look at the DNA of She Loves New York, and those two things had a child, and that was Eater.
That's funny. But what was interesting about Eater, and it started in 2005, right?
Yes.
So as I thought you were the wily veteran when I met you, right? Because you had had all of a year's experience, you know,
and
I was
had
like,
start on you.
Right, and I was like this old guy who's like, oh, there's this thing called the internet. How could I make this work? But one of the fascinating things about Eater, I remember you told me you were not in the business of opining. In fact, you steadfastly refused to go there. In fact, and I should say that I actually hired Ben to be a consultant for Serious Eats in early 2006, I believe.
Yep.
And the reason you were able to do it is because what I imagined Serious Eats to be was not in conflict with what you were doing at Eater.
So I think one of the important rules of entrepreneurship, as that's a theme here, is you got to know what your lane is. You really got to understand what your lane is. You got to understand what you do well, and by virtue of that, you got to understand what you don't do well. And we just knew that if we tried to do reviews with Eater, if we tried to be those sort of elder statesmen, the voices of authority, and issue these verdicts on restaurants, we were going to fall flat on our faces.
It was too heavy a lift.
It wasn't what we were any good at. It's still not what I'm any good at. I still wouldn't be a particularly good food critic. And so we just knew our lane was not that. You know, we wanted to talk about restaurants as these like living, breathing organisms that were local places where people could get obsessed with the chefs and the owners that were running them,
it was really personality driven.
Always personality driven, and that's what we wanted to do with it.
Yeah,
you know, with the reviews. Look, lots of other people at that point in time, and still today, much more so in 2005. Lots of people were writing reviews.
Right.
You know, there's lots of people that have lots of expense account money to spend and write and go out to dinner and get that context and write reviews. And we just knew that wasn't what we were going to be doing. We weren't going to be any good at it. So, you know. we had this passion and we had this idea, and it was much more interesting to pursue what Eater would become than to start writing reviews.
Right. And at the time, did you have a job when you started Eater?
I did. Eater was a moonlighting gig. I was still at VH1.
Got
at the
time. And Locke had a job
at Gawker.
At Gawker as the managing editor, right?
Correct.
So you were both moonlighting as entrepreneurs.
We were both moonlighting. It was a hobby that turned into an unhealthy hobby that turned into a business.
And I remember you and I once had a discussion where you said that what you were doing at Eater was you were in the business of creating heroes and villains.
Again, that's what we wanted to talk about, the people of the business. The restaurant business is filled with amazing characters. It was at the dawn of time, it was in 2005, and it is today. And that's the thing about it that I'm obsessed with today, I remain obsessed with, and that's the thing about that makes a business interesting, in my opinion, is the characters that create these restaurants, that inhabit this world. And yeah, and it's about heroes and villains.
Yeah. And did you ever pause at the portrayal of the villains? Like, did you ever worry? Because in essence, I think that's what got Gawker in trouble in the end. You know, they thought they were speaking truth to power, but they were still creating heroes and villains long after Locke had left to form Eater and Curbed with you. Do you think that's one of the ways that the internet became problematic?
I think that the internet got a little out over its skis. I think that, and certainly what happened to Gawker is emblematic of that. Where we were coming from with Eater is, at the end of the day, we were obsessed with these people, all of them, every last one of them, whether somebody that we were breathless about in a positive way or
snarky. Breathless
or snarky or were just totally confused or confounded by. We were obsessed with these people. And that's what made it a great site, because that obsession. And so
even if it veered towards a little bit of darkness, that was just a byproduct of the obsession.
I think that's exactly right. And I think the other thing is as Eater grew, I think in the restaurant business, there is a sense, or at least there was a sense relative to Eater, that all press is good press. And so even when we were sort of not necessarily being nice to somebody or not complimentary, we were raising awareness,
right?
About a person. On
yeah,
a show
I remember
for a character.
There was a panel that you were on in Aspen, and Danny Meyer asked you, you know, you printed something on Eater that turned out not to be right, and you said to him, "Look, everybody knows where to find me, and we're always happy to correct." And I think that speaks to two things that were going on then, and maybe are still going on now, which is, the internet was, at the time, very now-oriented. It's like, what's happening at 12:07?
Reverse cron.
Right, reverse cron. And I remember Danny was sort of appalled by that notion because people were used to the old-fashioned journalistic standards, which is, you know, you triple check, you make sure, you know, everything has to be vetted thoroughly and edited thoroughly. And it was a very different time.
I think that's true. I think it was a different time. I think it was much more fast and loose, primarily because of the sheer volume of content we were producing. I think if you look at how the space has evolved now to the present, you know, at Serious Eats or at Eater or at the New York Times, there's much less micro content being produced. We're a little bit, we've kind of pulled back a little bit. We've kind of reverted back to the mean, if you will. And now things are a little bit more considered and
yes,
a little bit more polished up and packaged up. And that's, there's lots of reasons that's the case. But it does mean that a place like Eater is definitely not as fast and loose as it used to be.
And it's not just because of the change in ownership when it was bought. It's because it's what the times demand.
I think that that's right. I mean, I think that that's right. It's what the design demands. It's what the cadence of the site demands. It's what the time demands. Yes.
He did say in the same sentence, Eater, the New York Times, and Sirius XM. So I love that. But you know what the weird thing about that is? It's kind of true. I'm really proud of that. It's
like,
you know, I used to write a lot for the New York Times, as you know. And I could have, that's what my goal was. It seemed like an impossible and lofty goal. It's like, I want this to be as authoritative as the New York Times is, and I want to bring the same journalistic standards, and I want it to be fun and human.
Yeah.
You know, like that was the whole thing. It's
yeah.
like that's Serious Eats in one sentence or two.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that when you look at what things like Eater and Serious Eats did to the conversation relative to the New York Times, we basically broke down all the walls. We decided what we were going to do is move fast. We were going to be unapologetic but engaged. We were going to correct things as we go. A lot of it was really ephemeral at the end of the day. There wasn't really a notion that these things would sit on the top of a website for days at a time. That was the opportunity that existed for Eater and I think for Serious Eats and lots of other publications more than 10 years ago. When you think about the landscape today, now that opportunity is being taken by things like Snapchat and Twitter and Instagram.
And Facebook.
And Facebook, right. And those are now the sites where things can go for a quick pop and then they die. And content sites like Eater and Serious Eats, as a result of where you know, those newer players, or BuzzFeed's in there too, as a result of where they're going, they've kind of pushed us back to the, being closer to the New York Times and than the blogs of 2005.
And when you mentioned that when you started Eater and even She Loves New York, that authority was not the goal.
Not at all.
You know, it's like, because you just didn't feel like you could live up to that promise.
We didn't know enough.
but now it is true that, you know, Serious Eats, I'm really proud of, that it is a source of authority. And I always used to pitch it, even I think when you and I were working together, it's this combination of community and authority, you know, which is unique to the web, at least it was back then, and maybe still is, because in the web, if it was old media, the web took the form of authority, but still didn't know how to incorporate community, right? And blogs and websites were really good at creating community, but as you said about Eater in the beginning, you couldn't pretend that it was about authority because you didn't know enough.
We always thought of it as talk radio.
Yeah.
Sports talk radio, you know, that was what was in the car when I was growing up. And so somebody calls in, has an opinion, you talk about their opinion, you move on to the next topic, somebody else calls in. That was what Eater was.
And so you left Eater under still mysterious circumstances that none of you have ever really clarified. But whatever, you left. Did you know at that point that you were meant to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I mean, I think by then, the just sort of the day-to-day of building Eater, of building the Curb Network, I think by then I was identifying as an entrepreneur for sure.
And yet the next thing you tried was to try to fit within a corporate framework, which is not anything you had a lot of experience with. Was that hard? Was that a little bit like diving into a really cold pool?
Well, it was.
I should say that what Ben did, you went on to work with NBC Universal on a whole restaurant. You know, it was very much in the spirit of what you were doing, but you were trying to do it on a corporate level.
It certainly is the right question. I think what NBC hired me to do was to think not like a corporate drone. I mean, the whole point of bringing somebody like me to a place like NBC was that they wanted to change things up.
Right. But wanting to change things up and being able to change things up in a big company are two different things.
Totally different. I always think, you know, you have to give a company like NBC credit for at least being self-aware enough to try it.
Sure.
And it turned out at the end of the day they were willing to do some things that felt kind of daring for NBC. But I wasn't hired at NBC to be, you know, an NBC stiff. I was hired to make people a little bit nervous. To the extent that the feast was any good, I think we did some of that. You know, I think the timing ultimately was terrible because it was just as NBC was being acquired by Comcast and the priority shifted as they do in a corporate setting, right? But we actually tried a couple of things that we didn't have the resources to try at Eater that were sort of percolating.
Right, you were
trying.
I remember you did a restaurant rating that was supposed to be an aggregation of all the authorities in the marketplace.
We wanted to create Rotten Tomatoes for restaurants, which is still one of those ideas. Now entrepreneurs come to me, and I see like one deck, one deck a year, one deck every 6 months on that idea. I think that there's still something to it, but we definitely tried and we didn't get there on it. It was quite hard. I think we ran into lots of obstacles that maybe technology is farther along today. Somebody will figure it out.
And then you moved to kitchen surfing, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that was an entrepreneurial effort. Explain to people what that was and how that came about.
So kitchen surfing was a marketplace for private chefs. If you're somebody who wants to have a dinner party in your house and you want to find a chef to cook, you could go on kitchen surfing and put in some basic parameters and kitchen surfing would match you up with a chef. It didn't work. It wasn't a good cultural fit for me. I was only there for a year, and the business itself, it was around for 3 or 4 years and ultimately shut down. I think it's an idea that will work at some point.
Some other context.
Yeah, I mean, the private chef business is quite a large business, and there are virtually no technology tools to organize the business, to create a marketplace. And I think if you do it in the right way, I think chefs would be happy to sign up for that kind of service. But it didn't work at kitchen surfing, and so it shut down.
And did kitchen surfing come to you?
Kitchen surfing was already in existence, and one of the people that invested in Eater had been an investor in kitchen surfing and made a match between me and the CEO.
Got it. So that didn't work. But, you know, one of the things that I think about all the time in Serious Eats and being an entrepreneur, you know, not a reluctant entrepreneur, but it was a decision to start your first entrepreneurial venture at 52 is a lot different than you know, they always say about entrepreneurs, what is it? Fail early and often.
Yep.
And you didn't fail. You had a mixed record.
Yeah.
But talk to me a little bit about the necessity to deal with risk and uncertainty when it comes to setting sail on an entrepreneurial venture.
Yeah, I mean, I think risk tolerance is got to be one of the three most important things that you need as an entrepreneur. I think you have to be willing to take risks. You have to have a real understanding of what you're good at, and you should take risks on the basis of what you're good at.
Mm-hmm.
And you need enough self-awareness to know what's not going to work.
Right, rather than, there's a hole in the marketplace, but I'm not good at it, so maybe I shouldn't attack it.
Yeah, I think that self-awareness is really quite important. Something that's worked for me, when it's worked, has been domain expertise. And when it doesn't work, it's because I really didn't know enough about the thing I was trying to do. Or I didn't have the team around me that I needed for it to work. But entrepreneurship, it's about risk taking, but it's also about being selectively confident. You have to be really, really confident about decisions when you make them.
So you have to know what you know and know what you don't know.
You have to know what you know. You have to figure out what you don't know. And as quickly as you're willing to say, this is how we're going to do this, it's my company, that's the final answer. As quickly as you can do that, you also have to be willing to say, you're right, we're going to go in a different direction.
It's true. The ability to pivot is of paramount importance, right? Because you're pivoting far more often than the world describes you as pivoting when you're running a business.
Well,
you're pivoting all the time.
A lot of times when you're building a company from scratch, the first 18 months is a series of micro pivots. You know, you're trying things. You have a sense of, to me at least, you have a sense of the lane you want to be in. But then you got to find a product market fit. And that's about trying one thing, trying another thing, licking your wounds, trying something else, slowly getting to finding that lane that's the sweet spot.
Sure. So where do you think we are in terms of people starting a business in the digital food space based on their passion for food?
I mean, you certainly couldn't start an Eater today.
Or even a Serious Eats.
Or a Serious Eats today with a couple hundred grand and expect it to work. Sometimes it happens. You're seeing from time to time a ton of traction really fast on a site like Instagram. You know, you could build a platform on Instagram relatively fast.
Right. But then you're using another company to build your company, which means at any point they can say, we don't need to do this.
Yeah, you don't have a control of your own destiny,
yeah.
That's for sure. I mean, you know, you can build an audience and then you can push them somewhere else maybe. But Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I always think, no matter what time, no matter what moment in time, if you have a really good idea and you're the one person who knows how to execute the best, then you've got a really good chance. But again, you know, that execution and that really having that idea and being crisp and vibrant, and you've got the timing right, you've got the execution strategy right, you know your point of entry,
you have enough money,
the right team, you've got the right amount of money. That's when you put all those things together, then, you know, building a successful business is really threading the needle. But I don't think it's any more possible or less possible today than it was.
It's just different.
10 years ago. It's just different. Yeah. Different constraints, different challenges.
You are still an entrepreneurial optimist, the way I think all entrepreneurs are in some ways optimists.
You have to be, don't you? I mean, this is the most cliche thing you could possibly say, but there's really good days, and then there's days when you think it's all going to hell.
Yes, so, I always tell.
You've got to have a strategy to get through those days where it looks like it's the last day.
Yep, I always tell people, I experienced the highest highs and the lowest lows in creating Serious Seats, and they often occurred in the same day.
They could occur in the same hour. They could occur in the same 5-minute span. I mean, that's. You know, you got to be an optimist if to get through that.
Yeah, it's true.
At least you've got to be an optimist in terms of you believing in your own ability.
Yes.
To figure it out.
It's
even
true.
Even if you think the world around you, like, no one's ever going to get it. I'm totally screwed. Like, you know, there's nobody else in the universe who I can talk to about this. You've got to somewhere dig down and figure out and find a belief in yourself to get through it.
Yeah, and it requires a resilience that you have to find out that you have in those moments.
100%.
Yeah. So, God, we've talked about your entrepreneurial endeavors, and some have been obviously more successful than others. We haven't even taken a deep dive into Resy. Will you come back to talk about Resy?
I'll consider it.
Thanks, Ben Leventhal, for sharing the entrepreneurial roots of Resy. And so long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.